Dallas Police Accountability and Mutual Aid organizer Walter Changa Higgins took a quick break from preparing meals at the Warren United Methodist Church to tell reporters about Dallas group organizing efforts. Higgins has been working in coalition to deliver hot meals to camps of people experiencing homelessness and doing wellness checks in low-income neighborhoods of color in South Dallas. Higgins said the group's work has been most important in regard to people with mobility issues or others who are worried about leaving their homes or encampments. The city did a pretty good job on setting up stations and places for people to go to get warm. But the problem is actually getting people there, Higgins told reporters. Then they were using electronic ways of letting people know that these resources are out there. And if your power is out, then how are you charging your phone to be able to see all these resources? The climate-fueled storm, Higgins says, amplified long-standing issues of environmental racism, lack of development, and old and neglected infrastructure in the under-resourced neighborhoods of South Dallas. These communities have long suffered a cycle of environmental degradation after major highways broke up neighborhoods and invited heavy industry into the area, which in turn has long taken an environmental and health toll on the community, creating a downward spiral. When the storm hit, these issues compounded, and the city hasn't done enough to mitigate the harm, Higgins says. That's why he and other mutual aid organizers are doing all they can to help support the largely black community. The inaction on the city level from the mayor, just not having a citywide coordinated response for this type of work, I think, is a big value statement about the way our city operates, Higgins says. But you layer all those things on top of each other and you've got a serious crisis. You've got systematic problems coming to bear in real time and breaking down and eroding everything even more with folks not having power and not having water. Meanwhile, on the border, organizers with the La Union del Pueblo Intro, LUPE, distributed gift cards, blankets, and food to poor Latinos living in border colonies during the freeze last week and are continuing to provide aid as conditions improve. LUPE Communications Coordinator John Michael Torres told reporters that some colonies' neighborhoods also lost water after power went offline, since the wells they rely on use an electric-operated pumps. Many fled to family members' homes or hotels, which were quickly booked. Other border neighborhoods that have basic plumbing also experienced burst pipes, like so many others in the state. In the colonies, as in South Dallas, Torres says the freeze exacerbated already existing problems of environmental justice. Many of the colonies' neighborhoods that lost power and water are the same neighborhoods that have been hit the hardest by flooding, as predatory housing developers built some neighborhoods on semi-rural land in the region's floodplains. Many of these neighborhoods are located in South Texas City's extraterritorial jurisdictions and are still waiting for cities and counties to extend proper wastewater removal infrastructure to their areas. These are the same neighborhoods that have suffered for years from the effects of poor drainage, property damage, and sickness that comes with flooding, Torres says. These areas where people are marginalized in a very difficult way from jobs and services are also marginalized from the spaces where they can lead active and healthy lives. The impact on the geographic marginalization of these communities plays out in sicker, less healthy communities that struggle more, and then when there is a bigger, badder storm that hits, they are even more vulnerable. Mutual aid organizers and directly impacted Texans want to see real consequences for state leadership's negligence and violence. In particular, people are calling attention to Senator Ted Cruz, who fled the state to vacation in Cancun, Mexico, and Governor Abbott, who appoints the three-member Public Utilities Commission, PUC, overseeing the nonprofit Electric Reliability Council of Texas, ERCOT, which operates the state's independent grid and initiated the statewide blackout that affected up to 4 million Texans recently. Abbott has shifted blame to ERCOT, calling for investigations and reforms to the grid operator as an emergency item for the 2021 legislative session, allowing the state legislature to approve bills on a topic during the first 60 days. But Abbott's blame game in regard to ERCOT, much like his misleading statements about the state's wind turbines, avoids his own culpability. Experts point out that ERCOT doesn't even possess the enforcement power to require energy generators to upgrade and winterize their facilities. The legislature would need to implement those requirements, and it's up to the PUC and the Texas Railroad Commission, which regulates oil and gas, to enforce regulations that apply to power companies. King Hollis, whose pipes burst and flooded his home in McKinney, Texas recently, wants to see ERCOT abolished and Texas become integrated into the U.S. two larger national power grids. Hollis is a black filmmaker who has worked on issues of police perpetrated violence and with the Dallas-based Earth X Film to showcase environmentally themed film on Earth Day. After his pipes burst, recently, he and his family and friends worked to bail water from his home using large containers for a number of hours before they were forced to evacuate. He is now staying with a friend while dealing with the aftermath of the flood. I think Abbott's whole move regarding ERCOT is spin and a political shield to continue business as usual. He is going to slap people on the hand, keep the deregulations and cuddle corporations, Hollis told reporters. What the hell are you trying to reform? You are reforming something that does not work, because we have seen here cannot be fixed with a couple of notes from the governor. His experience, Hollis says, is evidence of environmental racism and the ways in which the state's leadership has created environmental sacrifice zones and communities like his for the sake of deregulation and a corporate bottom line. Hollis railed against Senator Cruz abandoning his post as a public servant to vacation in Cancun. It is time to replace these politicians. It is time for people to run for office and get these babysitters for corporations out of office, he says. I've got a hot hand for a hot ballot. My hands are ready for that ballot box. Still, Holly says he was overwhelmed by the amount of support he received from friends and neighbors of all stripes who reached out with offers of food, water, and a place to stay. We have to stop letting politicians and pundits on cable news tell us who we are, Holly says. We know what to do when this hits the fan. We define ourselves in times like these. South Dallas Mutual Aid Organizer Higgins agrees ERCOT should be abolished. It would be good for us to integrate the international grid because then there would be some kind of federal regulation, but there is just a lot of players here and a lot of elite folks who have made a lot of money that want to see things stay the way they are. In addition to wanting Texas to abolish ERCOT and rejoin the national grids, organizers are calling for deeper investments in vulnerable communities of color and in the renewable sector. They want a Green New Deal. We do need an investment in green energy, green jobs in our colonies, in our region, and throughout the state of Texas. LUPE's Torres says, there is no reason that our community members, our sons and our daughters should have to travel off to West Texas to work in the oil fields or the Gulf Coast to work on the rigs, when they should have clean green jobs here at home.
Another controversy for the private U.S. security firm Blackwater. A confidential UN report says Eric Prince, the company's founder and former head, has violated an arms embargo on Libya by sending mercenaries and weapons to support Libyan renegade general Khalifa Haftar. The report, obtained by the New York Times, details how Mr. Prince, a close ally of former U.S. President Donald Trump, deployed heavily armed foreign troops to eastern Libya to assist Khalifa Haftar in the heat of an attack to capture Tripoli in 2019. According to the UN, the $80 million operation included plans for the mercenaries to assassinate selected Libyan commanders. The report raises questions about possible ties between the operation and the Trump administration. Prince did not cooperate with the UN investigation and has rejected having anything to do with the military operations in Libya. However, the report exposes him to possible UN sanctions.
Well, it's all the same thing, that it broke the law and that he was told to do it. I mean, it doesn't really make much of a difference. In fact, the laws or international law and laws are meaningless to the United States. And in 2011, when the U.S. led the NATO bombing to destroy the Libyan government and the government there, and for regime change, that was against international law, but it didn't mean so. They break international law all the time. When they level sanctions against countries, these are violations of international law. And so, you know, that's it's par for the course. It's very telling, though, that they would be doing this use of mercenaries.
Since 2014, two rival seats of power have emerged in Libya, namely the internationally recognized government of Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj and another group based in the eastern city of Tobruk, supported militarily by Haftar's troops. The damning 120-page UN report on Blackwater's contract in Libya was another instance of military intervention by Washington-linked private security companies in the internal affairs of countries around the world. In recent years, there has been a surge in the activity of guns for hire in countries like Yemen, Nigeria, Ukraine, Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Some of the mercenaries have capabilities and equipment on par with elite US troops. But Blackwater is not the only such American firm that is active in conducting high-level overseas operations. Back in May, Venezuela arrested 13 individuals charged with planning an operation in the capital Caracas, two of whom were American nationals. The U.S. mercenaries admitted that they were arrested during a failed attempt to raid Venezuela's presidential palace and seize President Nicolas Maduro.
We had a casual conversation, I guess you could call it a verbal contract, giving me some vague mission guidelines on training Venezuelans coming here and putting Maduro on a plane.
The two said they had been working with Jordan Goodrow, an American military veteran who leads a Florida-based security company called Silvercorp USA.
The measures that the United States will take for regime change to advance their interests, very obscene, immoral measures, are revealed all the time. The reason why they like to use mercenaries in a lot of these things and what they do, and then the academy, or this group that used to be Blackwater, got its notoriety for doing things that gave the United States plausible denial.
The involvement of the U.S.-backed troops in these countries wasn't the first, and certainly won't be the last. But does the growing number of operations indicate that the U.S. is opting for a more indirect means of intervening in other nations' affairs?
Recently published satellite images by the International Panel on Fissile Material have revealed that Israel is expanding its Dimona nuclear facility in the Negev Desert. Israel has acknowledged the existence of the Dimona nuclear reactor, however, it neither confirms nor denies the purpose of the facility. The site has provided the Israeli regime with the material needed for its nuclear arsenal. According to a report by a non-profit organization named Federation of American Scientists, in 2020, Israel possesses close to 100 atomic nuclear warheads that are made from plutonium produced in a Dimona heavy water reactor. However, other sources have put that figure at 300, with some estimates even going as far as 400 nuclear warheads. The Israeli regime has a deliberate ambiguity policy on its nuclear arsenal, which means despite being the only possessor of nuclear weapons in West Asia, it always refuses to accept or deny having any. Israel has always turned a deaf ear to international calls on nuclear transparency, and it has never allowed any inspections of its nuclear facilities. With the US's invariable support, the regime has so far defied the international calls to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT. The treaty aims to halt the spread of nuclear arms and weapons technology. This is all while Israel has constantly accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of weaponization of its peaceful nuclear program and assassinated several nuclear scientists in recent years. However, Iran has rejected all these accusations, as it was among the first nations to sign the NPT. In January, Iran's permanent representative to Vienna-based international organizations, Kazem Gharibabadi, denounced favoritism towards Israel by the International Atomic Agency. He said such a treatment has given the Israeli regime the audacity to ridicule the watchdog and press ahead with its advancing nuclear weapons program in defiance of international calls. Israel's possession of nuclear warhead poses a significant threat to regional stability. The regime has carried out bombing campaigns against Syria for the past years. It's threatened Iran militarily on numerous occasions. And when it comes to Hezbollah, Israel has repeatedly threatened to destroy the resistance group.
First of all, they want to keep it as secret as possible. But there's another reason for this, and it's because Israel gets a large amount of economic and military aid from the United States. It's the biggest recipient of U.S. aid. And there is a bill that was passed, 60 years ago, the Symington Amendment, which said that we cannot provide aid to any nation that has a nuclear weapon and is not part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Israel's name has been synonymous with aggression, illegal occupation, and war with regional countries, as well as other international crimes. In August 2018, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu threatened Iran with atomic annihilation, right from the regime's Dimona atomic weapons facility. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif slammed Netanyahu by calling his statement beyond shameless. The regime is the center of fabrications against Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program, which is subject to round-the-clock monitoring by the UN. Israel has made baseless allegations against Iran, saying it is developing nuclear weapons, yet the regime owns atomic warheads and refrains from allowing inspections of its facilities. Unlike Iran, Israel has so far refused to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty, whose aim is to prevent the spread of nuclear arms and weapons technology in defiance of international pressure. Several countries have helped out Israel to develop its nuclear arsenal. They have secretly sold the Israeli regime material and expertise to build warheads. These nations include the US, France, Germany, Britain, and even Norway.
Well, you can draw the conclusion that perhaps the United States likes volatile regions. The more death and destruction, the better. It survives on this, and it invests extremely heavily in the most powerful military regime on the planet.
However, Israel's nuclear weapons project would never have succeeded without a major contribution from France. Surprisingly, Paris took the toughest line on counter-proliferation when it came to Iran's peaceful nuclear program, whilst at the same time it helped lay the foundations of the Israeli regime's atomic weapons. Whilst Israel has fabricated accusations against Iran's peaceful nuclear program, it's the only possessor of atomic warheads in the West Asia region. There have been growing calls for a region free of nuclear weapons. So why then have the US and Europe themselves turned a deaf ear to such demands?
US President Joe Biden's administration has announced three symbolic gestures toward Iran in an apparent break with former President Donald Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. Ned Price, a spokesman for the State Department, said Thursday the Biden administration was willing to meet with Iranian officials and other world powers involved in negotiating the nuclear deal. Price said Washington would accept an invitation from the European Union's top diplomat to attend a meeting aimed to discuss a diplomatic way forward on Iran's nuclear program.
Well, the U.S. is trying to play a little game here by saying, I'm going to go to Europe and I'm going to meet Iranians and I want to talk about the JCPOA, and maybe the U.S. will lift some sanctions. It's just the message the U.S. is just not getting it right. The U.S. needs to understand when Iran stopped giving false hope that there is no return to the JCPOA unless the Americans lift all sanctions, apply the lifting of the sanctions, allow Iran to sell its oil and to make deal with other companies as stated in JCPOA, and then Iran will stop withdrawing from the nuclear deal.
Washington says it has lifted travel restrictions on Iranian diplomats accredited to the United Nations, headquartered in New York, limitations that were imposed by Trump in 2019. Also, in a letter to the UN Security Council on behalf of Biden, acting U.S. Ambassador Richard Mills said the United States has withdrawn three letters from the Trump administration that claimed the U.S. had reimposed UN sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Mills said that sanctions measures terminated in Resolution 2231 endorsing the nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, with six world powers, remain terminated. This is why the overwhelming majority of the members in the 15-nation council had described Trump's bid to restore UN embargoes on Iran as illegal, arguing the U.S. was no longer a member of the JCPOA. In a tweet, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif responded to the U.S. acknowledgement that the snapback mechanism of the JCPOA has not been triggered. He reiterated Iran's position that Washington must lift all sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled under the Trump administration before Tehran reverses its scaleback of the commitments under the nuclear accord. Zarif had earlier urged France, Britain, and Germany, three European signatories to the nuclear agreement, to abandon their calls on Iran to act first to salvage the JCPOA and instead demand an end to the U.S. quote, economic terrorism on Tehran. In a reaction to the U.S. announcement that it would accept the EU's invitation to a meeting of Iran and the P5+1, Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said P5+1 no longer exists due to Washington's withdrawal from the deal. He repeated Iranian officials' stance that the U.S. must first put its words into action before Tehran follows suit. Even after the U.S. exit from the JCPOA and the reimposition of sanctions, Iran remained fully committed to the accord for a year before gradually reducing its commitments in five steps, citing the failure of the European signatories to the deal to keep their end of the bargain.
Iran made it very clear the government is forced to abide by the decision of the parliament, and the parliament decided to implement several steps, one after the other. The first one is the 21st of February, and on the 21st of February, Iran will withdraw from the voluntary protocol and will reduce the sudden inspection of the atomic energy inspector. Therefore, the Americans need to understand that there are other steps that will follow if the sanctions are not lifted.
The country has times and again noted that all the retaliatory steps are reversible once all signatories honor their obligations.
Myanmar has been the scene of mass demonstrations against junta leaders ever since the February 1 coup. Anti-coup protesters have defied a crackdown by the military, taking to the streets in several cities across the country almost daily. Demonstrators are demanding the release of the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, who was detained along with a number of parliament members. They're also demanding the restoration of civilian rule. Myanmar's junta has ratcheted up security measures to quell anti-coup demonstrations, and the internet in Yangon has been down for several days. Junta leaders deny they staged a coup and justified their power seizure by alleging widespread voter fraud in November elections that Suu Kyi's party won. They also pledged to hold new elections soon. This, however, has failed to calm down the situation.
I guess a lot of times with the Burma army and the Burmese dictators, they are always above the law. So why he doesn't calm the situation is because he doesn't want to calm the situation, because he wants things to be under his control, and he wanted to hold on to the power the way he wants to run the country. And that is why, although you will see a lot of chaotic going on, and you would think that if he is sincere about, if he's talking about the election issues and election is fraud, if that is the case, then why violence?
The army generals have filed multiple charges against the deposed leader, including ignoring an import and export law over walkie-talkies that were found in her home during a search. The Nobel laureate's lawyer says she has also been hit with a second charge, which is violating the country's disaster management law. Observers believe the accusations against Suu Kyi are an indication that the military is seeking a permanent grip on power.
Nobody knows how long the military is going to hold on to the power, but it is very worrisome that they probably may not want to let go the power, because for so many reasons, especially those who are in power, like high-ranking position like Mae Aung-le. He has so much political ambition in order to become the president, and even more so in order to control and have control over his own economic ambitions.
The military seizure of power has drawn global reactions. The United Nations has warned the army of several consequences of any harsh response to protesters. The UN Special Rapporteur said Myanmar's generals will be held accountable for any suppression of the civil disobedience campaign there. The coup also drew reactions from other international players. China said the situation in Myanmar is not what Beijing wants to see. It also rejected social media rumors that China was involved in the coup as complete nonsense. However, China, along with Russia, says the coup is Myanmar's internal affairs. The United States, however, has taken a different stance. Last Wednesday, U.S. President Joe Biden announced new sanctions on those responsible for the coup and any entities linked to junta leaders. Biden said Washington will be ready to impose additional measures. There is also the risk of a new confrontation between U.S. and China, maybe over Myanmar.
I mean, look, yes, the U.S. is talking about threatening to impose sanctions, targeted sanctions especially. And what did they do in the past week? They did impose some targeted sanctions, but it's just on, what, on the gems companies. But the most important thing to follow, to go behind, is the oil and gas company that is owned by the military. That is where they make a whole bunch of money in order to buy their submarines, their warplanes, all kinds of sophisticated weapons, which we call Mag and Mel, the oil company. They didn't do anything about it. That is something we wanted to see the U.S. will sanction.
The two nuclear-armed countries are already facing off on a range of other issues, including the U.S. interference in China's periphery, such as the South China Sea and the Korean Peninsula, as well as the trade and cyber wars between them. Myanmar is just another geopolitical war threat for China and the U.S., but observers believe Beijing has an edge over Washington in this struggle.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, hastiness. Speed has become a fashion and necessity in the digital era. The limited resources and the growing population have necessitated the development of speedy service as fast food, express ticketing, quick visas, fast lane traffic, and so on and so forth. Even the time is moving on the fast track. Years get completed before we count the days. Burgers and pizzas profit from our hastiness and laziness. People seek a slimming center to shed the flab faster. No family likes to waste time on the household works and instead engages a servant or gadget. The ill effects of rushing up in everything are not understood by many. They're just not paying attention. They're just going with the status quo. The irony is that humans want everything faster other than one thing, and that one thing is death. To understand the value of patience and tolerance, certain routine life activities and their effects will be discussed after the break, but know that hastiness has become our life today. Everything that we are doing is in a haste. Everybody is rushing. Everybody is trying to get from one point to another in a very limited amount of time. They're trying to get things done in a very hasty manner. And hence, when it comes to even acquiring knowledge, there are so many who are hasty and they just want one-liner answers. Well, guess what? Haste is not always a good thing. As a matter of fact, generally speaking, haste is something that puts you in trouble and you have to compromise and suffer with the consequences later on. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the topic of hastiness. And we said that our lifestyle today has become based on hastiness. Health is the casualty we pay. Fast foods save time but endanger our health. All kinds of disorders like obesity, diabetes, and blood pressure are caused by them. The desire to get things done faster makes a person restless and anxious, which in turn produce emotional setbacks of anger, stress, and depression. Eagerness to earn more in a short amount of time results in the least care for health. Isn't that right? Aren't we not seeing this? Well, another downside of hastiness is wastage increase. Citizens turn hasty on the road. Vehicles move at a breakneck speed during the peak hours of traffic to make up the time lost on unwanted things. Consumption of fuel and lubricants goes up apart from the tear and wear of the vehicles. Rash driving causes disability and death. These are again some of the negative aspects of being hasty. Then some people expedite the delivery of their child to have a fancy birthday, like the first day of the new year or any other memorable event. In the eagerness to make the kids smarter, parents put them in school at an early age, while some train their wards in driving to show off to the world. All these over-enthusiastic acts actually burden the children, depriving of the fun and frolic due to their age. Meat manufacturers force the animals like chicken to swallow the food to make them grow faster in the shortest period. All of these are because we have become hasty, which is a negative trait, and hence Islam wants us to think through our decisions and our moves and our actions and observe patience instead. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
While millions of Texans continued living without safe drinking water and many faced storm damage and massive electricity bills, youth leaders with the Sunrise Movement rallied at the state capitol in Austin, using the current conditions across the Lone Star State to bolster their demand for a Green New Deal. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Corpett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, As Millions in Texas Lack Safe Water, Sunrise Movement Rallies at State Capitol Demanding Green New Deal. Here's more. While millions of Texans on Monday continued living without safe drinking water and many faced storm damage and massive electricity bills, youth leaders with the Sunrise Movement rallied at the state capitol in Austin, using the current conditions across the Lone Star State to bolster their demand for a Green New Deal. Texas is the perfect example of what happens when politicians cater to fossil fuel executives instead of the young people who have been shouting from the rooftops for years, warning of an impending climate emergency like this, said Sunrise leader Chance Davis in a statement ahead of the rally. The Houston teenager's family moved to Texas in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. I've survived three once-in-a-lifetime storms in my 17 years of life, Davis said. We need change, and the Green New Deal is the obvious, urgent solution. As our communities come together to fill the void of our government, our leaders must invest in us to provide jobs that directly address the crisis we face. The group has been a key proponent of the Green New Deal resolution introduced in 2019 by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey. The recent deadly winter weather, which experts have linked to human-caused climate change, led to major power outages across Texas, the only state that mostly relies on its own electricity grid. Some Republicans, including Texas Governor Greg Abbott, try to blame renewable energy and warn of the not-yet-implemented Green New Deal, but the outages were largely tied to fossil fuel and nuclear facilities. Though much of the state now has power again, Texans are still dealing with water and food issues. Concerns are also mounting over the hundreds of thousands of pounds of pollutants, including benzene, carbon monoxide, hydrogen sulfide, and sulfur dioxide, that Texas oil refineries released while scrambling to shut down during the storm. Climate campaigners within and beyond Texas have responded to the state's cascading crisis by ramping up their calls for a Green New Deal, which would create millions of jobs, by transitioning the nation to 100% clean power, while launching a Second World War-style mobilization to build resiliency against climate change-related disasters. In a petition open for signatures from Texas residents, Sunrise lays out four key demands, including the resignation of Abbott and U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, who came under fire recently for fleeing to Cancun for a vacation as his constituents endured the fallout from the storm during the coronavirus pandemic. Direct immediate relief. We need canceled utility bills, direct cash assistance of $2,000 per month, a rent freeze, and specific support for most marginalized community members. A 100% renewable, resilient energy system and good jobs to build it. A public, well-regulated power system to make a state and country more resilient to future disasters and create good union jobs for the communities. Joe Biden must come to Texas, where Texas leaders have failed Americans. The President of the United States has an opportunity to lead. He must come to Texas and help the suffering and use this moment to take urgent action on the climate crisis and build the resilient power system of the future. The resignation of Greg Abbott and Ted Cruz. Abbott and Senator Cruz have neglected their duty as public servants in the midst of this humanitarian crisis and must step down immediately. They are unfit to serve. Journalist and environmentalist Naomi Klein noted Cruz's attempt defense of the trip in a tweet promoting the Sunrise Rally. Klein, author of This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate and Other Books, argued in a column for New York Times that Republicans fear the Green New Deal because it offers a viable alternative to the collapse of a 40-year experiment in free market fundamentalism that Texans are now enduring. The horrors currently unfolding in Texas expose both the reality of the climate crisis and the extreme vulnerability of fossil fuel infrastructure in the face of that crisis, Klein wrote. So, of course, the Green New Deal finds itself under fierce attack, because for the first time in a long time, Republicans face the very thing that they claim to revere but never actually wanted, competition in the battle of ideals. In a statement recently calling on Abbott to resign over his handling of the storm and his lies about the power outages on Fox News, Sunrise Digital director Paris Moron declared that we deserve a government that addresses our basic needs and protects all of us in the moments of crisis. Despite the lies you will hear from Governor Abbott on Fox News, that's truly what the Green New Deal is all about, said Moron, whose family in Texas lost electricity, had food go bad, and lacked consistent running water. We want to come together and rebuild an era of prosperity through the decade of the Green New Deal.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
The issue of treacherous and malicious sanctions. Those days, the 19th of day, we were not well equipped, but today we are equipped with the intellectual, practical, political, and thankfully military weapons. We have also overcome many obstacles, and the goal is to establish a new Islamic civilization. This is our ultimate goal. It is possible that one generation may not achieve this, but the path will continue by Allah's favor. Future generations will attain this goal. We should overcome imperialist transgressions and vicious policies that they formulate against our country. Our positions against the US government originate from this outlook, this argument, and this philosophy. These points were about the 19th of Dey. As for the current affairs of the country, one of the most repeated issues in the challenge between the Islamic Republic and the Front of Arrogance headed by the US is the issue of sanctions. Another issue is Iran's regional presence. Yet, another is Iran's defensive and missile power.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
They constantly say something and nag about it, and this side too says something in response. Of course, our officials have responded to the Front of Arrogance on all three issues, our military officials, our Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and our people, with their slogans have responded to them. But now, I wish to say the final and definite word in this regard. As for the sanctions, the Western Front and our enemies are obliged to stop the malicious move, imposing sanctions against the Iranian nation immediately. It is their responsibility to lift all sanctions. This is a treacherous and malicious move, and it is grave and unreasonable enmity against the Iranian nation. They are showing enmity not only towards the Islamic government or the administration, but also against the Iranian people. It is their responsibility to lift these sanctions immediately.
Around the World with Reporters.
The Gaza Strip began its coronavirus vaccination campaign using the Russian Sputnik V vaccine. Medical workers will be the first to receive the jabs. The vaccination comes after long delays by the Israeli regime that only allowed a small shipment of the vaccine to reach Gaza last Thursday, after coming under heavy criticism by human rights organizations. Another shipment of the Russian vaccine arrived then through the Egyptian-controlled Rafah crossing on Sunday.
Today, we begin the vaccination of COVID-19 in the Gaza Strip, and God willing, we will be able to control the spread of the deadly virus and have herd immunity.
Nearly 55,000 people in the blockaded Gaza Strip have been infected with the coronavirus, mostly since late August 2020. Some 550 Gazans have also died of COVID-19.
The Gaza Strip is one of the most overpopulated areas in the world. Vaccination will play a major role in preventing the coronavirus pandemic and lowering the number of deaths in case we can manage to inoculate people as soon as possible. First doses would go to frontline medical workers, vulnerable patients, and the elderly.
Local authorities in the Gaza Strip struggled for months to lower the coronavirus infection rates through strict measures. The Israeli blockade has compounded the struggle of health workers in Gaza, undermining their efforts to contain and track the spread of the coronavirus.
This vaccination campaign is one of the main measures of the Ministry of Health to control the spread of this pandemic, along with other protocols. This vaccine will give immunity to those who receive it and in turn will lower the number of daily infections.
Hundreds of Gazan patients have already lost their lives in recent years due to the Israeli regime's inhumane practices under the watchful eye of the international community.
As vaccination begins in the blockaded enclave, experts say Tel Aviv must end its illegal policies and remove any barriers that may hinder Palestinians from accessing proper medical care. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The highly anticipated February 22nd announcement is finally here, marking what the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson calls his roadmap out of lockdown, following pressure from members of his own Conservative Party to explain how he plans to reopen the country.
We cannot persist indefinitely with restrictions that debilitate our economy, our physical and mental well-being, and the life chances of our children.
But restrictions won't be lifted in one fell swoop. Measures will be conditional based on four tests, with the government set to examine the data at each stage before unlocking further.
One of the first places to reopen, schools, which the Prime Minister, not long ago, described as potential vectors of transmission, causing the virus to spread between households.
In the devolved nations of Wales and Scotland, pupils have already gone back to school. We asked a number of parents in London what they thought of their kids returning to classrooms.
Well, they've lost nearly a year of schooling, so they definitely need to get back to school.
As long as people are sensible and the schools, I think they've taken all the necessary measures to keep the children safe, then I'll be glad for him to go back to school.
There is still some risk involved, I suppose, but I'm hoping that, you know, as the vaccination program is going forward, and I hope this decision is supported by data.
Critics, among them leader of the opposition Labour Party, have criticised the government for missing the opportunity to jab the teachers and school staff.
If we'd used that last half term, that last week, to vaccinate teachers and school staff, we'd be having a better discussion about children back to school. But ideally on the 8th, I'll listen to what the Prime Minister says this afternoon. I hope he's got a good plan.
The government says it does, and that it hasn't vaccinated teachers and school staff for a reason.
There isn't strong evidence that teachers are more likely to catch COVID than any other group, because children are very, very rarely get symptoms or serious illness from the disease. The value, the importance of vaccinating children is to try to stop the spread of the disease.
At the moment, although death and infection numbers have gone down, there are still almost 20,000 people in British hospitals with COVID-19, and it's going to take months before everyone gets their first jab. It remains to be seen if this is indeed the beginning of the end for lockdowns in this country. Saeed Puriza, London.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has slammed what he called the arrogant, high-handed, unjust and erroneous rhetoric of the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal toward the Islamic Republic. Ayatollah Khamenei also denounced Britain, France and Germany for failing to comply with their commitments under the nuclear agreement. The leader also lashed out at Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has repeatedly accused Iran of trying to acquire nuclear weapons. The leader added that Iran will never bow down to U.S. pressure and will not back down on its logical stance on its nuclear program. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei referred to a law passed by the Iranian parliament in late December that requires the government to take additional action to reduce commitments to the nuclear deal, which includes a decision to end the voluntary implementation of additional protocol. The leader said Iran will develop its nuclear capabilities in line with the needs of the country, and for this reason, Iran's enrichment purity level will not be limited to 20%. He said Tehran may increase the level to 60% if it deems necessary.
We should remember that the framework around this whole thing here is that a number of nuclear powers are sitting telling what Iran should do, which is not a nuclear power, while other nuclear powers are not even discussed.
Following the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear agreement and its reimposition of sanctions in May 2018, Tehran exercised patience and remained fully committed to its obligations under the accord. However, a year later, Iran started to reduce its commitments in five